awareness as we transition from stillness to motion. You can begin to move your body from small circle into bigger and bigger circles in one direction, maintaining this clear awareness of the changing sensations as the body moves. Watch our very strong habits of allowing the mind to begin to scatter as soon as we hear the signal ending the formal practice period. And change direction. The formal sitting meditation period may have ended. We can continue our practice, maintaining this clear awareness of our body and mind, moment after moment. And please do feel free to stretch out your legs, massage your joints, make yourself comfortable. Chris asked me to figure out what I would talk about this evening, and so I thought I would share with you what I have been working with recently in finding a way to integrate our practice of cultivating clear awareness into our life living in groups, and that's the title that I gave Chris for this evening, Community Building as a Path of Liberation. We have a tendency to think of practice as a very individual matter, that we sit in meditation on our own and we think we are just dealing with our own mind. But if we really think about it, our experience of our mind really comes from our experience in groups, how we think of ourselves, how we make up what's going on around us, all from our learning from other people, interacting with others, watching how other people respond. And I want to talk about our life living in groups, in particular because we are really social animals. Some of us like to spend more time alone, some of us maybe in small groups, some of us maybe in big groups, but in one way or the other, we are social animals in the sense that we all have been trying to find ways to live with others, to be accepted by the groups that we want to be part of. And If you think about your experience living in group, you might recognize this feeling of wanting to belong, wanting to be accepted, or this very strong desire. And also at the same time, the fear and anxiety involved in being afraid of being ostracized or rejected or excluded by someone in a group or by a group that we really want to be part of. And when we take a moment to think about that, we may be able to recognize how much we create suffering for ourselves and each other in our life lived in groups. And Chris mentioned that I'm a sociologist. Maybe you don't know what sociologists do. Sociologists study group life. And so that's part of one of the things that we study and talk about. And we know a little bit of something about what happens in group life. And I thought I would share a little bit of that with you, because very often we live in groups, we feel that the group has some power over us, but it's very invisible or mysterious. We just feel like something's happening, but we don't know what. And that in itself can be very anxiety-inducing. And we feel like maybe there isn't anything I can do about it. Or maybe we blame ourselves for not doing what needs to be done. Whatever it is that you experience. Actually, understanding the dynamics of group life can help demystify that process a little bit. One thing I like to talk about is the mechanisms through which a sense of belonging is generated. We have we might think that, I feel a sense of belonging because I really like this group. That's why I feel I belong. But sometimes you might really want to belong to that group, but you don't feel like you belong because it's really not up to you only. And the experience of feeling a sense of belonging or a sense of cohesion or solidarity in a group really actually is a collective effort. So when a group of people come together and interact with each other more frequently, and when people inside this group are more interconnected with each other, meaning you don't just know one person, but you know you have connection with a lot of people in the group, and the group come together more often than not, this tend to generate greater sense of belonging in the group. So you can see it's not about you or how you feel, how individuals feel about a group. It's about the frequency of interaction within the group and how interconnected members of the group are. And it also has to do with how much members of the group feel this commitment to the shared belief within a group, which in itself is the result of the frequent interactions among the members of the group. And the way this comes about is that when members of a group come together and engage in interactions, and very often, in one way or the other, this group in itself will create some kind of rituals. We are engaging in one such ritual right now. We started with sitting together, meditation. My understanding is this group will then have an activity, either with a discussion or have a talk. So, and depending on the intensity of these group rituals, how much emotional energy is generated in the group, then the group will begin to kind of congeal around a sense of shared belief that actually takes on some kind of sacredness within the group. So, for lack of a better word, we call it a sacred object of the group. It can be anything. It can be an idea. It can be an idea that the group supports, or something that the group hates or objects. It doesn't matter. It can become very sacred and important for the group, attributed with a great deal of emotional energy that's generated by the group coming together, focusing their attention on the sacred object. It can be an idea, a belief, or it can be a person that becomes very sacred for the group. And this sacred object plays an important role for bringing the group together, and people form an attachment to it. And the idea of the person that's sacred, or the belief that holds the group together, sort of serves as a reminder for everyone when you're not with each other. It kind of feels like a magnet to bring you back periodically to come back together. That's when you feel the sense of attachment or belonging to this group. You might notice that you have these experiences, that you might be part of a group that doesn't gather very often, but every time you gather, you feel that you're really connected with each other. And that has to do with those collective rituals being particularly successful in generating a very strong level of emotional energy holding you to the group. And for groups that don't gather very often, that don't have these very successful rituals, interaction rituals together, then you will feel lower degree of this sense of attachment or belonging to it. So, this is a very sort of simplistic, but it's pretty basic dynamic of how sense of belonging is generated in a group. And you can all apply it and observe it in your own experience. That will help you actually understand why you feel like you're really part of a group, you're really attached to that group in some settings. In others, you're kind of, eh. So like you can take it or leave it, you don't really care. And how do you know you feel a really strong sense of belonging? That you feel very compelled to conform to the group's expectation of you. That's when you experience the power of the group and you. Feeling compelled to conform to the group's expectation means that you would do what you know the group expects of you, even though that might not be something that's convenient for you in that moment, or that may not be something that you really want to do, but it's like you actually really believe it, you want to do it. Even though that may not be really convenient for you as an individual, it's like you wholeheartedly wanted to do it. You're very devoted to the group. And you can see that this is the result of the dynamic, the structure of the group. We ourselves are only part of it. Involve other people participating, and also the group being set up that provide this opportunity for us to come together frequently in this particular way. And what happens very often is that when we feel a very strong emotional attachment to the group's belief, what I call the sacred object, or maybe the leader, whatever it might be, it can also cause us to become very protective of it. And anyone who is seen as disrespectful to the sacred object that symbolizes our group will be seen as an enemy of a group. And it will trigger some form of moral outrage if we're very devoted to a group, that we feel very protective of the group. And this serves the function of us knowing that this is us and that's them. We're drawing a line in our mind that marks our group. We experience this as a strong sense of devotion to the group, but that is held together by a sense of someone out there that we need to direct this kind of negative feeling towards them. And that's one of the mechanisms that hold the group together very often, which is by marking or identifying a common, for lack of a better word, enemy of the group. That they, that's not us. That also helps to hold the group together. The more strongly we feel committed and devoted to the group, and more strongly we feel against the they, we may also find ourselves being less tolerant of dissent within our group. So are you kind of thinking like them? Are you agreeing with them? So we might also find that in such situation, a little bit of anxiety, wondering when am I going to be marked the them, even though I'm really devoted. Is it okay for me to say something that might not be the official line of the group now? So there is this interesting phenomenon that in the group that is highly cohesive, that it feels good to be in part of a group like this. Everyone's like feeling really committed, really seeing eye to eye. But there is also this sense of there will be some element of being oppressed by the group because of its intolerance of dissent. It is this very intolerance of dissent that serves to hold the group together in this very tight-knit, committed way. As I'm speaking, I imagine you are running through your mind all the experiences you have in your life about different groups. In different groups, and help you make sense of why you feel the way you did or do in various groups. And just understanding this may help us understand that when we had those experiences, we might tell ourselves that something's wrong with me. Something's wrong with me. Why can't I just be like so and so? And we believe, as thinking of ourselves as an individual, we believe something's wrong with us. And that has to do with our not seeing that our experience in groups are conditioned. We have a tendency to believe that I want to feel this way, or I should feel this way, it's me. This habit, very strong, entrenched habit of self-centered attachment, believing that there is this inherently, independently existing me, self, here, experiencing this. But actually, it's no. Our experience in group life is constantly changing. Has to do with the very constantly changing conditions that I just talked about. We might have experienced this, that I was in the same, it feels like the same group that used to feel closer together. And then now it is not. What happened? We may think something's wrong with me, or something must be them, someone in our group. That's their responsibility. We begin to point fingers. But really, it is the dynamic of the group constantly changing. It may have to do with the structure of the group's gathering that alters how the collective rituals that we engage in together work to generate different levels of emotional energy that translate into our experience attachment to the group. And anyway, people coming together in a group are constantly changing, contributing to the group's collective experience. Every time is different. So if we allow ourselves to remember and keep in mind on how our experience in group life is conditioned and the dynamics that bring about these experiences, we might find that we will cause ourselves and others a lot less suffering. As I mentioned, you can see that through these mechanisms, we can cause ourselves and others quite a bit of suffering in the process. We worry about not being able to be an integral part of the group, not being seen as an integral part of the group. It's like, I may not be 100% agreeing with everyone else because I have my ideas. Should I say that? If I say that, I may be rejected. This anxiety can be quite a bit of suffering. What should I do? Should I not say anything? Whether you say anything or not, you feel this fear. And we might do it to others. Our very strong commitment, devotion to the group may cause us to feel so strongly against the they, whoever the they is, that's not supporting, respecting our sacred belief or leader, that we are generating this hatred in our mind towards the they. Every time, every moment, we give rise to aversion, however righteous, that is suffering. And when we do that very strongly, it instills fear in the mind of other members in the community. Huh, if the they will receive such wrath, does it mean that it can be directed to me if I say the wrong thing, think the wrong thought? The sense of their acceptance in the group is not unconditional. Generates fear, anxiety. So without our knowing, we are generating a lot of suffering for others as well as for ourselves as we live through a life in the group without cultivating awareness of what's actually going on. So as a sociologist, I for many years, this has been sort of like discussed and studied as if that's just what happens. That's what happens in group life, and when people come together, that's what's going to happen. I like to see that as because sociologists has been studying human beings who are very vexed, we have no awareness of how they are creating suffering for themselves and others. And as we've been practicing and studying the Dharma, we all know that it is possible for us to be less vexed, to create less suffering for ourselves and others by cultivating more awareness. So I think understanding these dynamics should be seen as a tool for us to see, to shed light on what often happens in group life. Chances are, that's what happens in a lot of our experiences, the dynamics are playing out. Because chances are we are mostly living in groups with a lot of vexed people. We're not living among very enlightened people yet. So, okay, we might see that dynamic playing out. But that doesn't mean that we have to fall into it. We have to fall into the habit of responding with vexations. So how do we integrate what I just talked about into our practice? I'm sure you have heard much teaching about how the mind works and all those things. But learning about how group life works can be another set of understanding for us to shed light on what's happening in this moment. We understand, when we understand our psychological dynamics, what goes on in ourselves, it sheds light on why we are reacting and responding a certain way, and give us space to unlearn that and not do that. We can do the same thing with by integrating understanding of the mechanisms that that groups use to generate a sense of belonging and solidarity, cohesion in the group. First is to see that this is what's going on. It's like, oh, okay. Well, the group is feeling this, and I'm experienced sort of like not really as devoted as I used to feel in the past. It might be because we're not getting together very often. It's really not about me, not about them. It's like the group is doing something different. So the experience of solidarity is different. It's conditioned. We hear that teaching all the time in the Dharma. But this is how is it conditioned? Is it conditioned in this way? So if you want to change your experience, there is something you can do. You can get together more often. It also helps us make sense of why different people in the group experience the group or have different degree of devotion or commitment to the group. If you participate more often, you naturally will have an opportunity to develop more greater sense of commitment or devotion. If for whatever reason someone doesn't participate very often, they may not have the similar degree of devotion to the group's belief as we do if we participate a lot. But we tend not to think like that. We tend to think that something's wrong with that person. They like, I'm really committed. I'm the good one. Something's wrong with them. They don't feel the same. But really, again, our sense of commitment to the group is conditioned by how much we get to participate. And also, another factor has to do with whether this is our only group that we participate in, or we have many different commitments. if we have many groups that we that compete for our time, that also will reduce the amount of the degree of our sense of devotion to a group. So again, that is conditioned by our circumstances. And this will help us empathize with others who have very different experience in the group. Instead of thinking that it is that something is wrong with that person or ourselves. It will also help us, I also encourage us to think about, in as we engage in life in our group, be it this Sangha or other groups in our life, to pay attention to how we are generating a sense of belonging in our group. What route are we taking? Are we choosing to generate our sense of belonging or cohesion primarily by declaring or identifying a common enemy, the they? That is a particularly enticing option because it's very fast. All you need to do is to declare a they and then focus your dislike, your hatred, or anger against them. It holds the group, it brings the group together really fast. And it's a very popular choice. And we might be choosing that without our knowing, because the experience of feeling that cohesion from declaring a they, a common enemy, it's very it's very comforting for a lot of people. They make them feel like they're part of something. And we can ask ourselves, is that what we want to do? Is that what we want to do? Cultivating this hatred in our mind against someone. When we can actually cultivate a sense of belonging in the group without having to do that, we can cultivate this closeness with everyone in the group and a deeper sense of trust by doing the work of forming a lot of connection with each other, by being fully present with each other. That takes more time, that takes more work, but the connection that's formed is actually deeper, and the community resulting from that is more solid. The cohesion that comes from declaring a them, it feels good. But the cost of that, besides generating hatred in our mind, is it also generates anxiety among our own members. The anxiety of not knowing when I would also be seen as a them. So in our practice of cultivating awareness, we can practice take attention to how we choose to develop this sense of belonging within the group. And it can be, it does not necessarily only involve what happens, what we do as a group, but also how we talk to each other, just one-on-one within the group. Do we make use of our common or shared dislike of someone outside a group as a way to bring us together, because that is really the same dynamic? Or do we develop a sense of connection by focusing on what we share? The practice, for example, we're talking about a Sangha, and our shared experience as fellow human beings. So we can pay attention to how we interact with each other in our group and see how we make those choices. It's not that easy. It's very easy for us to go for the easy route, to bond with each other by declaring a common enemy. So I thought I would share this with you this evening, and I want to see if you have any question or thoughts or comments. Thank you.
Something I've been thinking about a lot lately is the language of coercion, and especially friendly coercion. And I have a few friends that were actively talking about this a lot, about how there's a difference between, oh, come on, everybody's going, you have to go, versus, oh, I hope you go, but if you stay home, I hope you do good self-care or something. And that among a group of friends where we're talking about this a lot, we practice finding ways to say, well, if you make it to the concert, it'll be good fun, and if you stay home and sleep, you'll be rested tomorrow, or something like that. But some way that we're saying, because you're talking about like how much time you put into this group and the sense of belonging, and I think that it's very easy for us, or at least for myself, and I know for people I care about, to physically overcommit ourselves, go out and do the thing with the group because we care about that sense of belonging when we're tired or sick or have too many other commitments. And so I've been thinking a lot and talking with some friends a lot about ways to reassure people that they're part of the group, whether they come do the thing or not, and that we're thinking about them, and to look for places where language that seems friendly has a coercion element to it. Like, oh, we all want to see you there, sounds good, but it can create that anxiety versus, you know, we all want you to do what's best for you. We're lucky if you come, and, you know, something like that. So, as you were talking, of course, like you said, I found myself thinking about a lot of different groups that I'm in and how a lot of them are remote and we interact by email and instant messaging and whatever, and we actually don't get physically together very often. But that sense of belonging or anxiety can come through the kind of language that we practice in the group. It's something I've been thinking about a lot lately.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Like you said, like the you're talking about sort of like the coercive aspect of the group life, mm-hmm. that like you feel coerced into doing something that really may not be the best thing for you to do in that moment. Indeed, yeah. So here you're talking about sort of communicating this unconditional acceptance. Like, you know, we love you, you're still part of us. Even if you don't go this time, it's okay. Like, so we don't do that enough, right? Instead we language it in a way to make someone feel that is really conditional and generating that anxiety. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
us first, then a dialogue between the two of them rather than just forceful enemies.
Thank you. Thank you. It's interesting. Very often the them may not even be an actual people. Right? We imagine the them, like they who don't think the way we do. Like we imagine the them very often to hold a group together. And sometimes then we will identify certain people or group of people as the represent as an embodiment of this imagined enemy, them. So I think just noticing that we are doing that will make a big difference. Sometimes not an actual person, actual people that we know, that we are disagreeing with. We're just having this idea that there are these them that's not us, that's not agreeing with us. And we don't even know that. We think that we talk about the them as if they are real people. No, we're like, can you tell me the one actual person that you're talking about? You can't. We're talking about imaginary people. And so cultivating this clear awareness that we know, oh wow, I'm actually creating these people in our mind that disagree with us. But if you find that it's actual people that that we are disagreeing with, that actually will become much more straightforward. Just like, oh, why don't we sit down and have a conversation? The reason why we often can't is they are not actual people. That's our imagination. And so we can make them into anything we want. I don't know, is that what you're asking? Or do you actually have people you have trouble with, you would like to find out how to communicate with?
It's just more trying to recognize my own bias towards the group that I affiliate with, but yet communicating with the them. Recognizing a way to do it where they're not being insulted, I guess is kind of where I'm hitting roadblocks.
So you're wanting to explain to your group another group?
Or just, bringing up the concept of an understanding without alienating the person I'm trying to communicate with. I can kind of see it's just an awareness, trial and error. Is there a constructive way of trying to do this trial and error?
What I'm hearing is that you were sort of assuming that this person you were talking to has some certain view. Maybe you're mistaken. Maybe you don't know. Maybe really you don't know. So maybe like your idea of like, let me tell you what they really think, because you don't know how they are. You are creating this reified reality in your mind and this other reified reality. Like this. Two sets of imagination going on here. So it's like, how about starting with, you know what, I really don't know what anybody thinks. Why don't you tell me? Instead of like, let me translate this for you. That is not a good position to be in. Because you might misrepresent them, you probably misrepresent what they think. What do you think? And then maybe then they can tell you how they feel. Like maybe you find more common ground than you assume. We all like to assume that I already know what you think, and I know what they think. And then you don't agree. It's like we actually agree on a lot more things than we we assume, because we are human beings. We assume a bit too much often. So maybe trying to find out what they actually think. And I find, in my experience, that most people felt that they have never been asked what they actually think. I hope that might be useful.
Yeah, no, that's a valid point. Start with inquisitiveness and work from there.
Mm-hmm. Because then, yeah, because you might realize your original assumption might.
Because you're coming off of my own bias. Mm-hmm.
I like this topic a lot. It's not, I'm aware that it's not something that I actively teach, but it's something that I actively think about a lot. Which makes sense from a certain perspective, given my location in this community, for example. One thing that came up for me when I was listening to you was that what we're doing right here, every Thursday night, is really familiar, it's normal, it's typical for me. I've been sitting in a room at least one evening a week for over 20 years that has a format or a ritual consisting of roughly 30-minute or 45-minute period of meditation, some kind of talk, and a little bit of Q&A. And given my history with that, I don't challenge that. And I'm also really attached to, and believe that I should stay attached to, there's the view, often very traditional forms, right? So I like the tradition of this. And I liked it when I found it, which is why I stayed. But I had this thought for the first time as I was listening to you that that's a pretty odd form for most people who would just come in off the street and see what we're doing. You know, given how our society is set up, the mechanics of this ritual are pretty odd. So I just had that awareness. And the other part of that is, and I alluded to it already, I think that there's something that serves us as individuals. I think there's something that serves the Dharma in this predictable format that some people decide is safe. And that I have seen work in a lot of different communities. And I want to protect it. I want to protect the ritual. And yet, I'm also interested in how ritual or ceremony is adapted or changed to meet the needs of different people. Anyone, for example, who might not come in and just say, like, this is exactly what I want, this is exactly what I need. So it just, there's not really a question here, it just brings up an interesting piece for me to reflect on both the importance and value of ceremony and ritual and the way they work for who they work for. You know, and that's it. And how flexible do we want to be? You know, like you and I were talking, walking over here, about how I often give a very traditional Dharma talk, which is 30 to 45 minutes, but that in the past 6 months or so, I've been doing a lot more group work. And I've been observing you all, in case you don't know. And so now this is more of like a sharing to the group, because Rebecca knows this. I like the stillness and the quietude of that traditional format where there's a Dharma talk and a Q&A, or sometimes there's no Q&A, there's not really time for that. And I noticed that there's this sense of the attention is all on me. So we're maintaining an old hierarchical structure, and it's a little bit, it's connective, but it's also a little divisive. And then when we, like, I think it was last week, I handed out a sutta passage, and we had small groups, and we reflected on the passage, and then we reported out in a large group, and there was a different kind of connection. Some of you are here, right? And then I noticed that when people leave after a traditional Dharma talk, when people are leaving and as they're leaving the building, it's much more quiet, and people are much more introverted, quiet. And then when we do the group work, it brings people together in a different kind of way, and people are more social afterwards.
Thank you, Chris. I think, I don't know, you know, if you intended to leave it unsaid, I think sort of as Dharma practitioners, we sort of associate the practice with sitting in silence and not talk very much and not make noise. And but that is thinking that it only that is this practice will be an attachment to form. Practice happens in any form, whatever we do. Practice can go on in all parts of our lives. Because if we think that practice only occurs in certain forms, such as in silence, and when we are not, when we are refraining from interacting with each other, kind of more like a retreat, then we are setting ourselves up to think that, oh, once I leave this group, I go back home, then I can't practice anymore. When I'm at work, I can't practice anymore. Then it makes it very difficult to learn to make our practice continuous, happening throughout the day. You know, the period that we dedicate to formal sitting meditation, it's a period for us to train our mind to be familiar with the practice so that we can bring it into our daily life moment after moment. And so, like, do we want to be careful about sort of set in this very subtle way, establishing in our mind that practice only looks a certain way. And when we are talking and all that, that is not practice. Actually, that is at a high level of practice, because there's a lot more sensory stimulation, and you have to be aware of, you have to listen, also notice how you are feeling and responding inside you. And so that's why you do that with the foundation of meditative practice. Without that, then you just kind of being all anxious about what you should say next. You're hardly listening to the other person, and the usual way of not listening. And so that is why, in talking about how building community, like really living in group, can be a path for liberation. We live in society, and so if we only know how to practice as individuals, that is a very that is very inadequate form of practice. And when we're in groups, a lot more things going on. And what I talk about is one piece of it is how we are navigating ways to bring the groups together. Of course, there are also other aspects that I didn't get into which is power, competition for status, and all that dynamic also going on at the same time. So I just pick out one small piece of what's going on in any given moment in our life in a group. So, to kind of give you some food for thought and thinking and notice, cultivate this awareness of, well, this is going on. We usually so self-absorbed, we just worry about, like, do I look stupid? Do I look good? Do I look intelligent? It was like, we have no awareness of what is going on in this group and how it is affecting us. So we can begin to cultivate this awareness by having a little bit understanding of group dynamic. Chris, you told me to end 5 minutes before 8:45. It's my clock, my watch is saying 9:55. So
okay.
I let you take over.
Who's doing the announcements? Fee. Thank you, Fee.
Thank you all. We have a little bit more ritual that I take a lot of comfort in, which is that there are a few announcements at the end of each meeting, including at the back of the room on the table. There is a sign-up sheet. If anyone is not already on our email list and would like to get announcements of upcoming programs or other low volume information interested in the community.